Okay. So, let us start with the suttas. And so, in case you are, I don't know if anyone here is new to this, but the word sutta, the suttas, they are the word of the Buddha. And so this is really what we're going to come back to, is what the Buddha himself taught 2,500 years ago, and find our foundation for our practice in the word of the Buddha, because the Buddha is the one who started out this whole Buddhist tradition, and everything else only has a meaning because it relates somehow to the word of the Buddha. So the word of the Buddha is always going to be the most important part of the Buddhist tradition, and in a second we will see how important it actually is, just to get some ideas of why we are studying these things. So the suttas today, they are going to be like an introduction for why the word of the Buddha matters and what the word of the Buddha actually is, because it's not necessarily all that obvious. And then we're going to use that as kind of the scaffolding for the rest of the retreat and all the suttas we're going to look at. The theme for this retreat is the 37 aids to awakening, the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. Bodhipakkhya Dhamma. Bodhi means awakening. Pakkhya means on the side of. It also means like the wing, because the wings are on the side of the bird. So they are less the side of. So it also means wings. So sometimes translated as the wings to awakening, or the factors that factors or wings either way. And Dhamma just means like quality or teaching or something like that. 37 aids to awakening is a nice translation. So the very first sutta today is here. You will see the little contractions there, DN29. Just for those of you who may not know, DN stands for Digha Nikaya, and Digha is the Pali word, Pali being the language, pretty much the language of the Buddha, very close anyway. Digha means like long. And Nikaya is a collection, so this is the kind of the collection of long discourses, and 29 is the number of that particular discourse, the 29th discourse of the long discourses. And this discourse is called the Pasadika Sutta, which translates as something like the delightful discourse. So, you will see there that a lot of the suttas are just extracts, a small amount of what actually is in there. And if you want to read the whole sutta, you have the reference there, so you can go online, or if you have you may have the hard books in at home or whatever, or you can borrow them at the library in Dhammaloka or somewhere. And then you can actually read up the whole discourse if you're interested. This is one of the purposes of giving you these references, so you can actually look it up if you find it inspiring. So this is a small part of this very long discourse called the Pasadika Sutta. And this discourse happens towards the end of the Buddha's life. And of course, those things that happen towards the end of the Buddha's life are often quite interesting, because towards the end of his life, the Buddha lays down the things that are important in his teachings. He lets the community understand what they should be focusing on, how they should function after he's passed away. So this is a very kind of powerful time, in a sense, for the Buddhist community, because the Buddha is telling them how to be self-sufficient after he's gone. So, I will just read out from the sutta, and then I will comment on it as I go along here. And the Buddha says, this is the Buddha speaking here, it was Uddaka Ramaputta who used to say, he sees but does not see. What is it that seeing one does not see? You can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge. That is what he meant by saying he sees but does not see. He spoke in reference to a low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a mere razor. So here we have this person called Uddaka Ramaputta, and he has this saying, and the Buddha is not too impressed by the way he uses this saying. There are other ways of using this saying that we're going to come to in a second. And he kind of is a little bit dismissive of it, saying it is a low here means hina, it means like inferior, if you like. Vulgar is the Pali word is gamma. Gamma means literally of the village, so it means like ordinary. I think vulgar is a bit pejorative. It's more like ordinary or common. And worldly, portu, janika, of the ordinary people, of no spiritual significance. The Pali word is anatta sanghita. And this is another useful word, which is you find many places in the suttas. It has no benefit, that's what it means. Not connected with what is beneficial. Not connected with anything that has a real purpose or aim. In other words, it is something that is largely useless. So no spiritual significance is kind of okay. So who is this person, Udraka Ramaputta? And those of you who have been around for a while, you will probably recognize this name very quickly. Udraka Ramaputta was one of the Buddha's first two teachers. Actually, he wasn't even the Buddha yet. He was the Buddha to be. The Buddha, when he started out his life, he became a monk. He shaved off his hair and put on the ochre robes. One of the important things to understand is the Buddha actually was a monk, just like all the other monks. That's why people were often not able to know who the Buddha was. There was a large group of monks that didn't know who the Buddha was because they looked like everyone else. So he was also a monk. And so then he went forth, and after going forth and becoming a monk, the first thing he does is to check out the spiritual teachers that existed at that time. What information, what spiritual guidance is available in the present day? That's what he seems to have thought. And then he practices the path as far as he can under those spiritual teachers. He doesn't strike out on his own until he has kind of uncovered and understood all the teachings that are available at that time. And only when he has understood all of those teachings does he actually strike out on his own to realize the kind of final awakening. So one of his teachers is Udraka Ramaputta. And it's interesting that you find him here again, you find him in the discourses where you talk about the Buddha's awakening, of course, because the Buddha explains the path. And when he explains the path, he explains the various teachers that he had and how they kind of helped him in a certain way. But here, he occurs again. And the same is true also for the Buddha's other spiritual teacher, Alara Kalama. These were the two, Alara Kalama and Udraka Ramaputta. Both of them, they occur in a few places in the suttas like this. And this is one of those interesting things about the suttas, is that you see how certain things, they recur in one place and then are explained in another place. For example, in some places you might just hear a reference to the Four Noble Truths or the Five Spiritual Faculties or the Noble Eightfold Path or Dependent Origination, and then they are explained in another place. So the suttas are kind of, they are a whole. The parts often don't make any sense on their own, but only when you see the suttas all coming together do they actually often make sense, because certain parts are explained elsewhere, and without the other parts, the other thing doesn't actually make any sense. And then you have reference such as this, where people recur, the same people. So these were obviously, they seem to have been real historical personalities talked about, as if everyone knows who they were in this sense. And that's why they recur in the suttas. And this is one of those interesting things about the suttas. The more you study the suttas, you study the language of the suttas, you study the ideas that are there, you understand how coherent they are and how they all kind of fit together, you start to see that this is an independent literature that stands apart from all the rest of Buddhist literature. The suttas are like, they are a coherent whole, and almost all other Buddhist literature apart from the suttas, they have a different flavor to it. Whatever it is, whether it's the commentaries or the Abhidhamma or the Melinda Panya or it is the Mahayana suttas or whatever it is, it has a different flavor to it. It doesn't feel the same way. It is not as coherent. It doesn't hold together in the same way as the early suttas. And it is this coherence and this this unity in the suttas that make them special and makes it feel as if they go back to an author, a single author that existed at a certain time in history. And of course that author that existed in a certain time of history is of course the Buddha himself. So these are some of the things that make you kind of make you appreciate that this is, there's something special about these things, and it is kind of evidence, if you like, that they actually come from a historical personality, a personality that we now call the Buddha. So these are actually quite important points. It is important because it gives you a sense of confidence that these are real. Yeah, it is not just a kind of a mishmash of weird stuff kind of put together in a random way. There's something very complete and very whole about this that makes it special. And you get the feeling that these are real teachings for that reason. And there are many other reasons for thinking that these suttas are a historical record of what was spoken by one particular individual who we now call the Buddha. There's many good reasons for that. If you're interested, I can maybe mention more about those things later, and also where you can find some more information about this, because at least I find it very useful to have that confidence that there is something. This actually is real. It is authentic. It is not something. There's nothing. It is not just a kind of made up, something made up, but it is authentic. I don't know. I find this useful. In part, I find it useful because when you read words on the page, when you read the suttas, there's often the feeling that you're just reading some kind of some ancient, it's just print on the page. Yeah, you don't really know what it is, what it refers to. And the more kind of feeling you get that this is real, the more powerful the message often becomes. Because after a while, you start to feel that you are a real disciple of the Buddha. This is a real historical personality. There's something real going on here. And this makes the whole thing more powerful. Anyway, so that is the idea that he had, that when he talks about he sees but does not see, that is what Uddaka Ramaputta says. And of course, the Buddha has a much more profound use for this kind of saying. So this is how the Buddha sees this. But if one were to use that expression properly, he sees but does not see, it would be like this. What he sees is a spiritual life, the brahmacharya, which is fully, it says here, successful and perfect, but it's fully complete and endowed with all factors, nothing lacking and nothing superfluous. It is well proclaimed and it is perfectly pure. If he were to deduct anything from it, thinking in this way it will be pure, he does not see it. And if he were to add anything to it, thinking in this way it will be more complete, then he does not see it. That is the meaning of the saying, he sees but does not see. So what the Buddha is saying here is that the teaching that he has given is self-contained. It is sufficient. It is all you ever need is the teaching of the Buddha. Not only is it all you ever need, but it is also it also has all the aspects that are required for practicing the path properly. Everything is there. It's all you ever need, and there's nothing superfluous in there. Nothing you can deduct from these teachings and say, now it is even better, more pure, more coming down to the essence. And this is a very important statement by the Buddha, because it has a lot of significance for how we study the Buddha's teachings and how we think about them. The fact that there is nothing in there that is superfluous, what that means is that when you read the suttas, everything in there actually matters. And what matters in particular, because the suttas are so ancient and been around for 2,500 years, sometimes there may be kind of individual matters that may be slightly questionable, because after 2,500 years there are always some things that become questionable, because simply it's the nature of things being transmitted for a long time that sometimes they get a little bit distorted. It's almost impossible to avoid that. But those teachings that you find in the suttas, you find them again and again, the teachings that recur in many different places and many different contexts, those are part of the core teachings of the Buddha. And there's nothing there that you can just take out and throw out and think that then you have a more essential aspect of these teachings. So what this means is that we have to be very careful. You read the suttas, you have to be very careful that you don't kind of use just a contemporary standard for deciding what is right and what is wrong. If you use contemporary standards, very often what you end up doing is throw out things that are absolutely essential for the practice of these teachings. I'm just going to take two obvious examples. One of those obvious examples is the idea of rebirth. It is very important because it's very common in the modern world to kind of reject this as an ancient superstition or an ancient thing, and then throw it out and say, actually, it doesn't really make any sense. We're going to take the essence of the teachings. We're not going to take those things that are an ancient superstition and problematic. But when you remember that the Buddha said that there is nothing superfluous in these teachings, it makes you think twice before you throw anything out. Because you realize you may actually end up throwing out the whole baby rather than just kind of flushing out the bathwater. So keep the baby here. The baby is what we want. Because that baby has a chance of doing something for us. This is the value in these teachings. So we have to be very careful with not kind of throwing out the essence of what these teachings are about. And if you know anything about how rebirth is spoken about in the suttas, you realize it is so integral to the teachings. It is found in so many different places, in so many different contexts, that if you take it out, you actually don't really know what these teachings mean anymore. The very idea of awakening itself is phrased in terms of rebirth. The very idea of right view, of understanding the world in the right way, is actually in terms of rebirth. Some of the most fundamental teachings, like dependent origination, rebirth is integral to that. So once you, if you take something like that out of the teaching, basically you are left with a number of teachings that are not held together by one of the core aspects that forms the glue to hold these teachings together. And once you take the glue out of the teachings, everything just collapses, and you have to reinterpret everything and make something else out of it. And this is what happens in the very often. If you take rebirth out, you get all these people writing big books about how the teachings are really supposed to be understood. Forget about what the Buddha said, because the Buddha, he was part of a certain culture, and he didn't really know about the aspects of the culture to get rid of. So don't take that too seriously. That goes out, and then we will reinterpret in the right way. But that is taking our contemporary understanding of the world far too seriously, and forgetting that there is insights to be had sometimes that are way beyond that ancient cultures sometimes have insights into reality that we don't have even in the present world. And it's important to have that humility sometimes, not to be too conceited about our society. Just because we have made progress in many ways, it doesn't mean that we have made progress in all ways. And in some respects, particularly when it comes to the spiritual practice, I think we have actually regressed quite a bit from the time of the Buddha. Instead of progress, we probably have a bit of regression instead. So if the Buddha says there is rebirth, we should take it very seriously, and we should not throw it out too easily. If we do that, we may end up demolishing the entire thing which makes Buddhism possible. Especially something which is so core to the teachings. Another aspect of the teachings that I just want to point out now, there's many things that people sometimes throw out, and one of the things that people kind of put on the side is things like all the psychic powers the Buddha talks about, the idea of flying through the air and reading people's minds and all of that, and those things are much less important as far as Buddhism is concerned. So I think these things may very well be possible. I don't think can't see any reason why it shouldn't be possible in certain ways at least. But they are less important. So if you find those things difficult to understand or agree with, fine, it doesn't really matter so much. They are more like a byproduct of the path. They're not core essence or an essential aspect of what the practice is about. But there's another thing which sometimes is kind of left out of the Buddhist teachings as not being so important, and that is the deep states of stillness, the deep samadhi that the Buddha talks about in the Noble Eightfold Path, in particular the jhana experiences. Yeah, the Samma Samadhi, the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, is almost always defined as the four jhanas. And where it is not defined as the four jhanas, it is still refers to the four jhanas, because it is actually possible to show that from the suttas themselves. So this is another thing. Yeah, sometimes you hear about paths of practice that do not bring the jhanas into the path. And again, you have to be very, very careful, because one of the things that it becomes so obvious when you start reading the suttas, you start looking at the Majjhima Nikaya, you go from one sutta to the next one, and in every other sutta, you find the mention of these jhanas. So if they are not important, how come the Buddha mentions them in every other sutta? It doesn't really make any sense if they are so important to the Buddha that they're worth mentioning everywhere. And then we think that, no, they're too difficult, and because they're too difficult, we're just going to kind of leave them out. Then, again, you have grounds for being suspicious that you're trying to find a shortcut. Remember that one of the ways I like to think about the history of Buddhism is the history of finding shortcuts. Yeah, that's the history of Buddhism. Always trying to kind of find a new, shorter path. Yeah, I think that is... They specifically say that sometimes, yeah, the kind of the idea of different turnings of the wheel, etc., and all these kind of things, finding a shortcut, because the way the Buddha taught takes too long. Yeah, it takes too long. Sometimes you have to go from one life to the next one. I don't want to get it over and done with quickly here. If it takes too long, there's no time. We've got to get this thing sorted out, yeah, as soon as possible. But the problem is that the shortcut is actually really the long cut. You're going to be stuck in samsara even longer if you try to find the short. There is no shortcut, or the shortcut is the Noble Eightfold Path. Everything else is the long cut. Long cut? Maybe that doesn't work. Anyway, the long, right? Forget the word cut, it's long. The long uncut, or something like that. And so take the whole, the path is given. It is complete. It consists of eight factors. It consists of all of these things. That is what the path is. You need to practice all of those things. And if it happens to be difficult, the reason is because it's profound. It is a very profound path. So it shouldn't be easy. If it was easy, it wouldn't be worth anything. Yeah, if the jhanas were just a matter of sitting down and kind of watching your breath and feeling a bit of joy and bliss, and you think you are in first jhana, well, then it wouldn't really have that same value. The fact that it is profound is what makes this path so incredibly interesting. You start off getting a bit of peace and maybe a bit of joy in the meditation practice, and you think, wow, this is so wonderful. That's just the starting point. It's just the beginning. Then it goes on like that, on and on and on, deeper and deeper and deeper. This is what it makes it so extraordinary. And of course, eventually it leads you to all of these insights and everything, into an understanding of the nature of reality itself, and discovering the very meaning of life. This is why it is special. It should not be superficial. If it is superficial, it's not really worthwhile. So remember that. There's nothing wrong with things being difficult. There's nothing. It's not really difficult in an ordinary sense. It just takes a lot of commitment to get there. But there's nothing wrong with that. It just means the path is profound. And that's a wonderful thing. It should be profound. Otherwise, it is too similar to all the other things that we do in our life. So remember that. Nothing in this path is superfluous. We can't just throw things out and think that we have the same thing. We don't. Everything needs to find its place on this amazing Buddhist path, and only then does it kind of cohere. Only then is it kind of all work together and give the result that it's supposed to give. Nothing is superfluous. Occasionally, you have to also be circumspect. Occasionally, there may be things in the suttas that are not original and that you may want to take out. How do you know that is the case? Well, one of the reasons you will know that might be the case, if they are very marginal, something that is said maybe once or twice in the suttas. For an example might be the Buddha Maitreya. The Buddha Maitreya, or Maitreya as he's known in Pali, only occurs once in the suttas. So did the Buddha Gautama, did he really predict a Buddha Maitreya in the future, or did he not? If it only occurs once, it gets a bit dicey. So what you do then is that you look at the Pali Sutta, and if there are other suttas in other languages that are parallel to that sutta, you look at those and see, is the Buddha Maitreya mentioned in those suttas? It's exactly the same sutta, but it's found in Chinese or found in Sanskrit or found in Tibetan or something like that. You compare it with the Pali. And if it's not found in the other versions of the suttas, and it only occurs once in the Pali, then it all starts to become very uncertain and very unreliable. And very often, and especially in the case of the Buddha Maitreya, you can assume that I think those who have studied it have come to the conclusion that the Buddha Maitreya was not originally part of the this particular sutta. So it has been something that kind of was added in there later on. Why was it added? It was added probably for good reasons. Yeah, people don't do these things because they are evil or whatever. It's just that sometimes what is initially a commentary may then gradually kind of be included in the suttas because your memory gets confused about what is commentary and what is sutta. And this is actually one of the ways that new material gets incorporated in the suttas. And then this confusion arises because of that. So this is how you then find out that occasionally there may be things that are not original, but they are usually very marginal things in the suttas. The core things are, generally speaking, incredibly reliable. And if you compare those core things again with, as I was saying, with the same sutta in different languages, it's astonishing how similar it is. Often verbatim, exactly the same thing. Yeah, word for word, like the jhana formulas. You read them in ancient Chinese and you compare them to Sanskrit and Pali, and it's exactly the same in all the languages. That gives you a very strong confidence that this is the real word of the Buddha that you have. So nothing is superfluous. Everything is that is there is required. And the other thing here that it says that is that nothing is lacking here. Yeah, nothing is superfluous, but nothing is lacking here. And that is equally important in this context, because if nothing is lacking, it means that these suttas are sufficient to take you all the way to awakening here. All the aspects, all the parts of the path are right there in these suttas. You don't need to look outside of them. You don't need to go to any suttas that came much later, Mahayana suttas. You don't need to go there. You don't need to go to some of the Pali scripture that came after the Buddha. And I think it's important to mention the Abhidhamma in this case, because and the reason why it is important to mention the Abhidhamma is not because the Abhidhamma is particularly bad or anything like that, but the reason why it is important is because the Abhidhamma is often lifted up as being the highest expression of the teachings of the Buddha. And that's where it gets problematic, because the Buddha says his teachings are complete, nothing is lacking, which means that there is no higher expression. The highest expression of the teachings of the Buddha is not the Abhidhamma, it is the suttas. Yeah, the Abhidhamma is a later formulation of the teachings of the Buddha. It's much more philosophical than the suttas are. The idea is to fill in all the gaps and to add what seems as if they're missing in the suttas, yeah? And then the Abhidhamma got created in that way. But the Abhidhamma is a different kind of project. It's a different thing from the suttas. The suttas are pragmatic. They have a very clear purpose, which is to get us out of suffering. They're not really, there's not a philosophy to kind of understand the world in that sense. The Abhidhamma, on the other hand, is more like a philosophy. The idea is to create a system that explains the world fully, the mind, all material phenomena, all of these kind of things. And because of that, it has a different kind of purpose from the suttas. But the Buddha said that, that we should be careful with this kind of philosophy, because philosophy is endless, it carries on, and you will argue until the end of samsara if you start getting into philosophy. End of samsara is a long time, yeah? Maybe forever. In other words, you will never stop arguing, yeah? If you get into philosophy, because there's always disagreements, always different ways of looking at things. So if you want to hang out in samsara for a long time, then arguing about philosophy is a very good idea. Maybe it's a bad idea, actually. So the point is that these things are endless, yeah? There's no end in philosophy. And what is interesting, if you look at the you know, the later discussions between the various schools, this is exactly very often where the arguments arose. The arguments arose in terms of Abhidhamma, in terms of these ideas of mind moments and whether they exist or don't exist, or and whether they have a sabhava nature or not. Sabhava means like inherent essential nature and these kind of things. Because some people were saying, oh, it sounds too much like a self, and other people say, no, it's not really a self because it's conditioned in a certain way, and the arguments just roll on, and it's still going on in the present day. Yeah, these Abhidhamma arguments still going on right now as we speak, not here of course, but elsewhere. So they're still happening, because there is no final resolution to many of these things. So remember, the essence of the teachings are the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings. Coming back to the suttas, all the other things are much more unreliable than the early suttas. It also includes that other very famous work in Theravada Buddhism, the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga is like the Abhidhamma, is a wonderful creation, and a lot of interesting things in there. But remember, it does not supersede the suttas. Yeah, it is something that has been added to the sutta. It is a commentary on the suttas. If you want to know what the real teachings are, you have to go back to the suttas. But what is interesting, if you look at the large number of the kind of meditation systems you find around the world, especially in Theravada countries, they are based precisely on the Visuddhimagga. The Visuddhimagga becomes the scaffolding upon which most meditation is based. And that can be dangerous. It can be dangerous because you have moved away a little bit from the teachings of the Buddha, and you have moved into the territory of commentaries, and sometimes you have moved into the territory of creativity. You are creating new ideas and adding things to the teachings, and that is where the danger can arise. So I'm not saying that it is necessarily bad, but it can be bad, and that is what we have to be careful with, and why it is so useful to take the suttas as your gold standard. So come back to the suttas, yeah? Don't listen to what I have to say here. Yeah, I don't really. Just listen to what I have to say if it fits with the suttas. Why are you here? Why are you here? Actually, that's a good point. So, of course, the point is not that we shouldn't comment on the suttas. We need to interpret them, we need to understand what they are about. But we should make a distinction between just commenting and understanding what is commentary, and then coming back to the original and taking that as our gold standard. I'm just the latest commentary. My commentary, probably the most unreliable of all commentaries, yeah? So it's just one commentary after the other one. Still, I think these are important points. So it's up to you how you take these things. Okay. So very important things, very important for our understanding of Buddhism, because very rarely is the Buddhism practiced in this way. Just going back to the suttas and being more circumspect about all the other things. The Buddha says, therefore, Chunda is the a monk who he's talking to, if anyone were to refer to any brahmacharya, any spiritual life, as being fully complete and fully having all, being endowed with all characteristics, sabbakara sampada, sampanna, and sabbakara paripunna, I think the Paripunna or Parisuddha, either way, it doesn't really matter. Complete in all respects, based what it means. Then it is this holy life, in other words, the Buddha's holy life, you should be talking about, this spiritual life. So, there you are. So this is why I like to focus on the suttas and try to get the meaning straight from the suttas. It doesn't mean that I try to kind of neglect the commentaries and neglect later traditions. Very often they can be very useful as well, but it should always be seen in the context of the suttas. So now we need to find out, what is this holy life that the Buddha teaches? Yeah, this is what comes up next. Therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge, Abhinya, should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that this holy life may continue and be established for a long time. for the profit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, and for the benefit, profit, and happiness of devas and humans. So, here the Buddha is pointing out that these teachings, these truths that he has realized, which is also what he has taught his monastics and taught the lay people for the past 45 years. He's been teaching for 45 years, roughly at this particular point. Yeah, all of these teachings, what should we do with them? Well, what we should do with them, and this is speaking mostly to the monastic community here, you should come together and recite them. Gayitabang, this is Gayitabang, literally means to recite or to chant these suttas together. It's related to the word sangiti, and the word sangiti is often translated as council, and this refers to the councils or the coming together of the monastics after the Buddha passed away. The first council, yeah, when they kind of recited the suttas and the Vinaya, the monastic code, and this is exactly the same word that as is used for those councils. And actually, council is not a very good translation at all. It really means like a reciting together or a chanting together. And this is what you see here. So from the very early on, from the very beginning, the Buddha told his monastic community how these things are to be kept for posterity, how they are to be kept into the future. Yeah, and the idea is to come together, you chant them together, and when you chant them together, then anyone who has misremembered the teachings, they will be corrected because everyone else will know what is going on. Anyone who is new to the Dhamma, like a new monk, yeah, coming on board, they will listen to the chanting and they will also learn. And in this way, it is carried on into the future. One of the things about the Buddha, the way he, when he started out, if you remember the very first teaching of the Buddha is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which translates as the setting in motion, the wheel of the Dhamma. Dhammacakka is the wheel. And the idea here with the setting in motion, the wheel of the Dhamma, is like this wheel of the teaching rolling out into the world. Yeah, it's set in motion and it rolls out into the world. It rolls from one country to another one. It rolls from one era to another era, from one culture to another one. So it is something that kind of goes out and touches humanity, wherever there are human beings. This wheel of the Dhamma has the potential to touch the heart of human beings. And because the Buddha had this idea from the very beginning, yeah, from the very beginning, he talks about the Dhammacakkappavattana, setting in wheel the motion of the Dhamma, because he knew that from the very beginning, he taught these teachings in such a way that they were to be suitable for people everywhere. Yeah, so he already had this idea in his mind of these teachings being carried on into the future. And of course, the way to do that then is this, what he's saying here. This fits with what he's talking about here. You come together, you recite them, you understand what these teachings are about, and in this way, you carry them on into the future. And what is interesting, sometimes people are very skeptical that it is possible to have just merely by recitation, by having an oral literature. This is why it is called an oral literature, because it was recited in this way, and one generation would learn from the previous one, etc., etc. That it is possible to keep teachings intact and not actually misremember when it is an oral culture like this. But it is important to keep in mind that India had a very powerful oral culture long before Buddhism came around. The ancient Buddhist scriptures called the Vedas, like the Rig Veda and some of the other Vedas, especially the Rig Veda, it goes back at least 1,500 years prior to the Buddha. Yeah, and we know, and I haven't actually studied this myself, but according to scholars, we know that those Vedas, they were kept intact and memorized properly for many centuries and millennia, just almost verbatim, yeah, from the very beginning all the way up to the time of the Buddha and beyond. So, in other words, there was a culture already. There was a certain system for memorizing these teachings. And that system was then applied also among the Buddhists. And what you can see when you read the suttas and you compare them to some of the Vedas, you can see some of the same systems being used. Systems such as numerical listings of factors, systems such as having a narrative content for the suttas and these kind of things. And many of those aspects of how the Vedas were memorized were also used by the Buddha, because it was like a technology of oral transfer that already existed in the Indian culture. So Indian culture was very advanced in terms of much more, you know, probably the most advanced culture ever in terms of memorizing things, because this was such a very incredibly important part of the Brahmanical caste in India. This was their job, that was to pass this on, and this was like the essence of the Indian culture at that time, was these Vedas. So because of that, there is no reason why the Buddhists shouldn't have used that same technology, if you like. I don't know if the technology is the right word, but whatever you want to call it, culture, and use that to then also remember the Buddhist teachings well after they have been given by the Buddha. But we also know this for other reasons. We know this for other reasons because we also know that not long after the Buddha passed away, the various sects started to form within Buddhism. Yeah, you had all the various schools, and they started to divide out over large parts of India, some going south all the way down to Sri Lanka, others going north up to Kashmir and Gandhara in the north of India. And the distance between Gandhara and Sri Lanka is really, really large. India is a very big country. I think if you look at it on the map, there's about 3,000 kilometers between Gandhara and Sri Lanka. 3,000 kilometers is a long way. It is almost like the width of Australia almost. Yeah, and Australia is also another very big country. So yeah, it's very far. And at that time, when they didn't have planes, maybe they could they fly through the air? I wonder, that sort of destroys the argument a little bit. Let's say they didn't fly so much through the air. I think we can take that as given. So they didn't really have, all they had was like horse carts, ox carts. Yeah, and ox carts are notoriously slow and very bumpy and very not very nice. Has anyone here traveled in an ox cart before? You have it, right? Is it uncomfortable? Yes, it is very uncomfortable. So you try to avoid it to the as far as you possibly can. Okay, that's interesting. Thank you, Venables. We have some important experience here that kind of builds up the argument even more. So, because of that, these suttas were separated, and they were separated inside the oral period. It was still the oral period. And yet, when you compare them today and you look at how they fit with each other, they are basically still the same. So we know almost with certainty that oral transmission actually was very accurate, and they were able to transfer the suttas in the right way. And this is why this is so important, the idea of the Buddha laying this down from the very beginning here. So, and then it says here, you do this setting meaning beside meaning, expression beside expression, You ensure that you actually are transmitting this in the right way. The meaning here might be the kind of the understanding this in the right way. So this would probably be a little bit like the attakatha, the commentary, when you try to understand the meaning in the right way. Attakatha literally means talk of meaning, And this is the ancient Pali word for commentary, and then you, in this way, you then ensure that this is passed on in the right way, without dissension, If you have dissension about the Dhamma, it is bad news, so you try to avoid dissension, you try to find a solution to any problems you may have. And then, if that is all there, then the holy life will be established for a long time in the future. Even 2,500 years in the future, it will still be established in the far corners of the world, like Perth, Australia. It's really nice to live in the far corners of the world, actually. That's one of the great benefits of living in Perth. Far away, you find beautiful retreat centers such as this. These are much, much better. You're much better off in the far corners of the world to find a really good retreat center. So this is the advantage of living far away. And yet, the Dhamma has come all the way here, and still exists, and still exists, and still gives the same results if you practice it properly as it did 2,500 years ago. And you do that for the benefit and happiness, the profit and the happiness of the world, and for devas and humans. The purpose of the Dhamma is not to go around to say that I'm a Buddhist and to be nationalistic about it. The purpose of the Dhamma is to sort of actually has an effect in our lives. The purpose is to make us better human beings, to have more peace, more contentment, more happiness, more joy in our lives. That is the purpose. And that is really why the Buddha taught in the first place. Important to remember that. It's not just about keeping these things alive, it's about using them in the right way. So, now we come to the really important part here. what are the things that you should recite together? In other words, what are these teachings that the Buddha has realized, this truth that he has understood? And this is now we come to them. So, they are the four applications of mindfulness, or the four mindfulness meditations, the four right efforts, the four foundations for spiritual power, the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the seven factors of awakening, and the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things you should recite together. So here the Buddha says, this is what, these are the truths that he awoke to. This is what he realized on this, on the day of his awakening. This is actually what he saw, and this is now what he's teaching to future generations and to the Sangha, and what his 45 years of teaching has been all about. It's kind of interesting. If you look at other places in the suttas, you might see that he says he has taught the Four Noble Truths. Sometimes he may just say that he has taught the Dhamma and the Vinaya. But here he talks about these seven sets of factors. This is what he has taught. So what are these sets of factors? There are seven sets there altogether. And altogether, these are what form the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, the 37 aids to awakening. This is what it's referred to as this. And this is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. He doesn't say it just here, he says it also elsewhere. We're going to have a quick look at the next sutta is also very, very briefly going to have a look at the same idea. Buddha also says the same thing. This is the essence of his teachings. So this is what it's about. And what is interesting about that is that if you look at those factors, and this is one of the things I will point out as we go through them, is that they are all very practical things. These are all about how we apply ourselves, what we have to do to actually move forward on the Buddhist path. This is what these teachings are about. So the Buddhist teaching, again, is a practical teaching. It's pragmatic. It is the solution to a particular problem that we all have. And that particular problem, of course, is that we all would like to be more content, more happy, and have less problems in life. Ideally, we would like to find the ultimate happiness, if that is possible. And of course, to do that, you have to have a path. You have to have a practice that leads you in that direction. And that is what the Buddha's teaching is about. It's practical. It is pragmatic. It is not philosophical. It is about what we have to do and how we have to live. It's interesting, because you might think that when you have an insight into something, the Buddha talks about his own super knowledge, his insight into reality. You might think about that as maybe seeing non-self, or understanding suffering, or perhaps seeing dependent origination or whatever. It's like an insight into a specific thing, a specific kind of or a lack of something or whatever it is. But actually here the Buddha says, no, the main part of this is actually the insight into the path of practice. That is what really matters. So it's not a specific thing, it is a particular path. That is really what matters here. So keep that in mind, because again, this is so important, because sometimes it is too easy to get sidetracked by theoretical things and things that may not be directly relevant, whereas actually the Buddha is always on about the path. The path is what matters, and these 37 are all about that path. But of course, a path is not just a path, because a path also exists in a certain context. You cannot have a path without context to it. The path has to do something. It has to lead somewhere. It has to be expressed for a particular reason. And one of the things that you see when you look at those 37 factors in more detail, you see that there are also theoretical aspects to that path. So for example, you have at the very first one, you have right view, the very first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And of course, right view is often described as the Four Noble Truths. So there you have the Four Noble Truths right there in right view. So there are theoretical aspects, because the theoretical aspects are what give the container here, they give the outlook, they give the world view that is required for the path to make sense. The path only makes sense given a certain outlook, a certain way of looking at the world. And of course, that way of looking at the world then, of course, is the same outlook as the outlook that the Buddha had on his night of awakening, the understanding of the world as it actually is. And of course, when you look at it even more carefully, you find dependent origination is also part of this. Because if you look at the Four Noble Truths, the second noble truth is about the origin of suffering, and the origin of suffering is precisely dependent origination. Dependent origination shows you how suffering arises out of delusion or ignorance or lack of understanding, avijja, as it's called in the Pali language. So dependent origination is also part of this. Yeah. What about the five aggregates? The five aggregates, surely the five aggregates must be really theoretical, yeah? Five aggregates sounds really theoretical, yeah? Form, feeling, perception, or yawn, perception, what are these things again? Sankhara, consciousness. It sounds like a theoretical thing, yeah, for understanding the human being. But actually, they are not. The five aggregates, too, are really just a way of looking at suffering. And they are a way of analyzing a human being in such a way that we can gain insight into what it means to be human. So they're also ultimately practical. Yeah? It is just that you need a certain way to help you to look in the right place so you can uncover these profound truths. And the five aggregates is a way of looking at the human being to help you to uncover the truths that actually are there to be discovered if you look at these things in the right way. And that relates to the first of the Four Noble Truths, which is the noble truth of suffering. If you remember the first noble truth, the Buddha said specifically, in short, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. This is what suffering is. So it's found right there. Sankhitena panchapadana kanda dukkha, the Buddha says right there. So again, and in this way, you can say that these 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, if you take the whole Pali canon, the main four Nikayas, Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, connected discourses, and then the numerical discourses, it's about that big maybe, that's how it is, maybe 5,000 pages, that's the 37 Bodhipakyadhammas. So if you really want to know about them, this is not enough, you've got to read those 5,000 pages, It's not that much. 5,000 pages, you read it pretty quickly, if you have an interest in these things. Especially if you want to kind of focus on these 37 specifically, what you should read is the last book of the connected discourses, the Sanyutta Nikaya. Sanyutta Nikaya, the last book is called the Mahavagga. It means the great chapter. And it contains lots of suttas, hundreds of suttas on this on all of these 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, in different, according to the groupings that you find here. Anyway, so this is what it is, it's a practical path. So to get a handle on these 37, what they are, you may think, do I have to remember 37 factors? It's asking a lot, isn't it? 37 factors, often we can't even remember simple things, let alone 37 factors. So to get a handle on this, it is useful to remember that these 37 factors, really, what they are an expanded expression of the Noble Eightfold Path. There are different ways of looking at the Noble Eightfold Path and also an expanded version of the Noble Eightfold Path. So each one of these sets, they kind of slot in to different places on the Noble Eightfold Path and they expand it out. So you can say in one way that the Noble Eightfold Path, it has eight factors. In another way, you can say it has 37 factors, depending on how you look at it. So that is really what it is. It's just the Noble Eightfold Path looked at from a different angle. But it's very useful to have different angles, because the more angles you have, the easier it is to understand what this Noble Eightfold Path is all about. But then again, the Noble Eightfold Path itself can be collapsed into the sila, samadhi, panya, morality, meditation, and wisdom. So again, that can be collapsed down again. And the 37 Bodhipakyadhammas, as I just said now, they can be expanded out to the four Nikayas, to the 5,000 pages. So all of these things can be collapsed out and expanded depending on what the usage, depending on what you need at that particular moment. You can see it from many different angles. This is one of those remarkable things about the suttas, is how they kind of contract and expand, and how they all form part of a large picture, that larger picture being the Dhamma. Everything being like a little piece in a jigsaw puzzle, and the overall picture is the insight that the Buddha had on his night of awakening. So that is how to understand these 37. They are really just part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And now what I want to do is to show you how they actually form part of that Noble Eightfold Path, how they all fit together very nicely. I'm afraid that now is a bit optimistic because it's already getting quite late, so maybe I think now means 3 o'clock rather than now. It's just an interpretation of the word now. This is why you can never trust interpretations, because they kind of lead you astray sometimes. Yes, I think we better stop there, because otherwise we're going to get too far sidetracked with these things, because it is a little bit involved, and it's quite interesting and important to understand how all of these 37 work together here. So I'm going to stop there, and then we will continue at 3 o'clock with the rest of the sutta, and in the meantime, keep enjoying yourself, have a nice lunch, and then see you again at 3 o'clock.